My attitude improved when Lee and I returned to New York. I gave up my rent-controlled apartment and moved into Lee's small but charming apartment in the West 50s near the Museum of Modern Art. I have a touching memory of him carrying me into the bedroom on our first night together. We didn't stay there too long because we were able to find another rent-controlled apartment, this time with 6 big rooms across from Carnegie Hall. The comfortable old building, dating from before World War II, was owned by the same friend of my parents who owned the apartment I lived in before Lee and I married. The walls weren't in great shape when we first moved in, so I had them painted a pale shade of gray and bought gray velvet drapes. I thought it looked pretty attractive, especially the way the gray walls set off the red furniture I'd recently bought, some of which I still have in my apartment today. But my mother saw things differently. "The walls match your complexion," she said, on a visit from Florida. But then she went out and bought me a lovely red crystal vase and had it filled with gorgeous red anemones, my favorite flowers. She set the vase atop the baby grand piano she and my dad had given us. I still have the vase and the piano. "Now," she said, "everything looks wonderful." Oh, well. By this time, Lee and I had more or less settled into our marriage. We were both busy, had lots of friends, and little to be unhappy about. At the office, however, another major shift was going on. Pat Fontaine had been let go and left the program in February 1964. Once again, the Today Girl slot was open. Al Morgan got all excited about a well-known movie actress named Maureen O'Sullivan. He had been captivated by her performance when she appeared on Broadway in a comedy called Never Too Late. We had interviewed her on the show, during which she was articulate and witty. That cemented it for Al. Without further ado, he decided that Maureen would be the next Today Girl. He had great difficulty persuading the actress to take the job, but he finally prevailed by persuading her that it would be steady and secure, unlike the stage. Maureen, who had something like 7 children, including a daughter who would grow up to be Mia Farrow, took his advice and signed on. There were immediate repercussions. Hugh had made it very clear to Al that after the Pat Fontaine fiasco, he wanted to have a voice in the selection of the next Today Girl. Hugh had to share 2 hours a day with her on the air, after all, and he had cause to be concerned. He had not been consulted when Pat was hired, and, on more than one occasion during her erratic, boozy tenure, it had fallen to him to carry the show. But Al didn't consult Hugh about Maureen. He just went ahead, and while Hugh was on vacation, hired her. So you can imagine how Hugh felt when he came back to work to discover someone he had never met was now about to share the morning desk with him. That made for some uneasiness between Hugh and Maureen, and didn't do much for the relationship between Hugh and Al. They had been at odds for some time, but now it boiled over, on both sides. Hugh was furious at Al for hiring Maureen behind his back. Al was furious at Hugh for challenging his authority and began to develop a real dislike of him. Hugh was perfect in the morning slot, easily projecting the viewer-friendly image of a good-natured neighbor. But Al felt that Hugh was pompous and pretentious. The bad blood between them grew to such an extent that in 1968, NBC was forced to make a choice. Keep Al as the producer or keep Hugh as the host. Hugh refused to sign his renegotiated contract if Al remained on the show. There was no contest. Hugh Downs was popular and beloved by millions. Al was a force behind the scenes. Guess who stayed and who left? But that was in the future. The clear and present problem in 1964 was Maureen. Al had fallen into the trap that a great many producers still do. He saw someone who was charming and funny while being interviewed, so assumed that the same qualities would carry over to the role of interviewer. But it rarely works. Asking questions is very different from answering them, and a good deal tougher. Especially so early in the morning. The morning shows, I think, are the hardest to do. You have to be very versatile. One minute you'll be interviewing the Secretary of State. The next minute you'll be cooking cheese fondue with a guest chef. Because most of these shows are live, you can't afford to make many mistakes. You've also got to be able to get in and out of a commercial, in and out of a news break, in and out of whatever unexpected situation presents itself. For the most part, you have to know what you're doing. Maureen didn't. It wasn't really her fault. She had absolutely no experience or training in television, and no one took the time to work with her. She was thrust into a situation that was anathema to an actress. Her talent was to take a script, study a character, memorize the lines, and deliver them in a winning way to a live theater audience. Now, suddenly, there was no audience to play to, just the light on a camera, and there were no lines. The role she was expected to play was not the character in a script, but herself. Very, very tough for her. Things did not get better with time. Maureen continually missed cues. She couldn't control her interviews. She'd see a stagehand waving time cues frantically to her, and she'd ask on camera, "Am I supposed to end here?" Maureen couldn't get the hang of our man in the street interviews either. These had to be, by their nature, unplanned and unrehearsed. Too often, she cut off the person answering a question before he or she even had time to finish a sentence. When in doubt or out of fear, Maureen would simply throw the segment back to Hugh, or sometimes even to a commercial. She began to appear more and more confused on the air. The ghastly hour she had to awake to do the program didn't help. What we didn't know, until years later, when she wrote about it, was that Maureen was on a steady diet of prescription drugs. Anyone with a drug dependency, however slight, just can't work well under such pressure. You've got to be very disciplined and well-grounded to do one of these shows, and you really have to have a sane life. All we knew then, however, was that she was a terrible mistake. During the turbulent Maureen period, I had a miscarriage. We were broadcasting the program from California, and I was working very hard, too hard, perhaps. I wasn't feeling very well, which led me to hope I might be pregnant. I cannot tell you how much I wanted a baby and how exhilarated I felt when I came home and my gynecologist told me that indeed I was pregnant. I was over the moon. So was Lee. Then I lost the baby. I blamed myself for the miscarriage. If I hadn't been working so hard, perhaps I could have continued that pregnancy. I was devastated. I was then in my early 30s, and though most women at the time had their children at a younger age, I was still capable of childbearing. But I could hear the biological clock ticking. So I tried everything to get pregnant again. For 2 agonizing years, Lee and I went to one doctor after another and took test after test. The fertility treatments available today were not even thought of then. There was no in vitro fertilization nor surrogate mother. The very idea would have been considered science fiction. Getting pregnant was reduced to a combination of hormones and timing. I was told to check the exact days after my period to determine when I would be most fertile. At those times, I was to take and record my temperature and make sure that Lee and I had intercourse during the hours the doctor thought best according to my temperature. If the time was right, no matter if Lee was getting home very late from one of his shows or I was getting up at the crack of dawn for my show, we dutifully made love. Then we hoped and prayed. Finally, it worked, but only briefly. I suffered another miscarriage. Then, 6 months later, still another. Anybody who has been through a similar experience knows what an emotional seesaw it can be. You're ecstatic at the high point, then you all but fall apart when you drop to the low. Looking back now, a part of me wonders if it was some sort of sign. I feel guilty even saying it, but the truth is that I'm almost thankful I didn't have a baby. I think of my sister. Was her condition hereditary? Was nature sparing a child of mine the fate that befell Jackie? I'll never know. And I realize how harsh it might sound now. But back then, my hunger for a child did not abate even a little, and Lee and I would finally adopt a baby. But I'm getting ahead of the story. The concern in 1964 continued to be Maureen O'Sullivan. In August, we all went to Atlantic City to cover the Democratic National Convention that would select Lyndon Johnson, JFK's replacement, to be the presidential nominee, and Hubert Humphrey, the senator from Minnesota, to be his vice presidential running mate. It was only 9 months since John Kennedy had been assassinated, and his death hung heavily over the convention. Robert Kennedy, who would be assassinated himself 4 years later during his run for the Democratic presidential nomination, somehow summoned the composure to deliver the unity speech at the conclusion of the convention. There wasn't a dry eye on the floor, including the eyes of the hardest-boiled politicians, when he remembered his brother in a quote from Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. "When he shall die, take him and cut him out in stars, and he will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun." Maureen O'Sullivan cried too, but for a different reason. She got fired. There were political interviews to be done with campaign experts, critics, and pundits, not to mention prominent congressmen and senators. Hugh couldn't do all of them, and even though we writers gave Maureen plenty of research and carefully wrote her introductions, her questions, and even probable answers, she was lost and frantic. It was obvious that she just couldn't cut it. With a fierce campaign ahead between LBJ and Barry Goldwater, the Republican nominee, the on-air future for Maureen O'Sullivan looked pretty grim. Al Morgan finally bit the bullet and told her, in the middle of the convention, that he would have to let her go. Maureen was furious and felt betrayed by Al, who had leaned on her so heavily to take the job in the first place. But I think she was also relieved. "I was nothing but a bookend on the show," she later told reporters. The official word was that she had left the show by mutual consent, and Maureen went back to being a successful actress. Once more, the Today Show was without a Today girl. Al began his usual search for a star, but he had a problem. He still had to pay off Maureen's contract, which ran for another year and a half. She made a good deal of money, and he didn't have enough left to coax a new performer into getting up each day at such an ungodly hour and taking on the task of learning the ropes of a difficult-to-do early morning program. He had to hire someone who knew the ropes and would work for relatively little money. And he had to do it fast. Well, like the ingenue in a corny movie, there I was, the patient and long-overlooked understudy. Hugh was all for trying me out. By this time, I was a known and trusted colleague. Plus, I was no threat, and I could certainly perform adequately, if not spectacularly. "Why not Barbara?" Hugh asked. The NBC bosses knew why not. In essence, their unanimous response was, "She isn't known. She isn't beautiful. Sponsors won't take to her." But there was another response, too, and this one resonated as deeply as all the drawbacks they had saw in putting me on the air. "She'll work cheap." Hugh persisted, and this time Al, who rarely agreed with anything Hugh said or wanted, joined forces with him. The trick, they decided, would be to give me some on-air support. I would be on the program 3 days a week. The other 2 days, there would be two different women, both well-known to our viewers. Sometimes, when appropriate, I would also appear with one of them. I was very fond of both these women. One was Judith Crist, the witty and acerbic movie critic for the now long-folded newspaper, the New York Herald Tribune. She was already appearing on the program, giving her film boosts and pans. The other woman was a brilliant and delightful art historian named Aileen Saarinen. Aileen had, for quite a while, made art exhibits and other cultural matters not only understandable to our viewers, but entertaining. She was the only person I have ever seen on television who was able to do this effectively. The widow of the renowned Finnish-born architect, Eero Saarinen, she had graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Vassar and gone on to become managing editor of Art News, as well as an award-winning art editor and critic at the New York Times. Aileen had caught Al Morgan's eye in 1962 when she appeared on a CBS special about Lincoln Center, then under construction. She was an intellectual without being pretentious, so NBC executives agreed with Al's decision to hire her as a contributor. However, they didn't think she could carry a show alone. In those earlier days of the program, both Hugh and the Today Girl of the moment did the commercials. It went with the job. But the sponsors didn't want Judith or Aileen to do them. Judith was too caustic, they thought, and Aileen so erudite and elegant that she might turn off the audience. On the other hand, I was neither caustic nor erudite, and in those days, certainly not elegant. So the commercials fell mostly to me. One of the program's biggest sponsors was the canned dog food Alpo. These commercials were done live and featured real dogs panting away and licking their chops, waiting for the bowl of Alpo to be placed between their paws. While the dog gulped down the yummy glob, the person doing the commercial would extol the virtues of this dog food above all others. My first week on the air, I was assigned the commercial. The famished dog on a leash, but with a mind of his own, practically dragged me across the studio floor along with his bowl. The dog howled with pleasure. I howled with laughter. The sponsors howled with satisfaction. There would be conjecture that Al's upgrading to brains over beauty was fueled by the growing women's liberation movement and the consciousness of women's inequality in the marketplace. But I doubt it. Though Betty Friedan's classic call to arms, The Feminine Mystique, had been published to great acclaim in 1963, and Congress had just passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, prohibiting job discrimination on the basis of race and gender, I think Al's motive was more self-serving. If one of us was sick or didn't show up or bombed, he'd have two other women waiting in the wings. The three of us were his insurance against disaster. Much like the story of the advertising producer who hired triplets for a Johnson & Johnson diaper cream commercial to ensure that at least one of the babies wouldn't have diaper rash on the day of filming. Here's how the setup worked. Judith Crist was Today's movie and theater critic. Aileen was Today's art critic. I was just me. No one knew exactly what my role really was, including me. I'm a Lord knows what, I would tell TV Guide 3 months later. In the meantime, I was, thank heaven, no longer to be called the Today Girl. That airhead title and role was finally retired. If asked, I was to be referred to as a Today reporter. I started in my new role in October 1964, with no big fanfare, no publicity, and no official announcement. Because there was no hoopla, there were no expectations from viewers. I was on the air regularly before anybody realized I was there, three mornings a week, and then slowly, five times a week. Soon I was on, even when Judith or Aileen had their scheduled appearances. I conducted a lot of the celebrity interviews, introduced and narrated the fashion shows and other so-called women's features, and, where I had the most fun, sat at the desk and ad-libbed with Hugh, Jack Lasculli, Today's sportscaster, and the program's newsreader, Frank Blair. I began to feel that I was doing well, and even though my future was far from assured, I was exhilarated. I quickly discovered an odd disparity in my on-air and off-air persona. On camera, from my very first appearance, I felt calm, composed, and confident. Almost nothing threw me. I was an eager extrovert. Off camera, I was an introvert. If Lee and I were invited to a party and he was out of town, I wouldn't go alone. I was that self-conscious and still am, though less now. I won't dance alone either. To this day, I sit out the fast dances where dance partners do their own thing. Flailing around on my own makes me feel like a broken umbrella. I wait to dance until the music is slower and my partner can hold me securely in his arms. But I am not alone in this split personality. Many performers, and to a degree on-camera journalists are performers, are open and easy on television or on stage, but very shy in private life. Robert De Niro comes to mind. A great and expressive actor on film, he's almost tongue-tied in person. On the other hand, there are people who in private life are exuberant and even exhibitionists, but who suffer from such excruciating stage fright that they can't even rise to give a toast. At one point, Al sent me to a voice specialist to try and overcome my problems with pronouncing R. Lazy R's are often a product of being born in Boston with its particular accent, so I tried to fix it. These days, I've all but conquered the problem, but then the new speech pattern the specialist prescribed sounded phony and stilted. When several viewers wrote in asking why I was sounding so funny, I abandoned the specialist and went back to my natural way of speaking. Although, I did try, no kidding, to avoid sentences with too many R's. Hugh was wonderful to work with. He was always very generous in the assigning of interviews and didn't just grab the good ones for himself. He was confident and didn't have a jealous bone in his body. Over the many years we would work together, we never had a cross word. My relationship with Hugh, in fact, was one of the most satisfying of my life. Not only was I his protege in a way, but we became great friends. He had a wonderful wife, Ruth, and at that time two small children, a girl, Deirdre, and a boy, nicknamed HR. When the Today Show traveled abroad, Ruth usually accompanied Hugh and included me in their dinners, so I never felt alone. Hugh and I had different personalities and different styles, yet we complemented each other. He was more contemplative and thought of himself as something of a philosopher. His questions during interviews were gentler than mine, but he never restricted me from asking what I wanted. In short, he was, and is, one of the truest gentlemen I have ever known. One of my first interviews on Today was with Lee Radziwill, Jackie Kennedy's glamorous sister, who attended Sarah Lawrence College at the same time I did, back when she was Lee Bouvier. We lived in different dormitories, and she didn't stay long at Sarah Lawrence, but still, I thought she might remember me, if not from college, then perhaps as one of the few female reporters tagging along on the India trip with her and her sister. But she didn't remember me at all. By now, she was married to an exiled Polish prince named Stanislaus Radziwill. When I asked Lee what I should call her in the interview, she replied with a bored look, "Just call me Princess." "Okay, Princess." These early interviews highlighted another difference between my professional self and my private self, a difference I've never understood. It emerged in the editing process, a critical phase of almost every story in which I've always been very involved. To my surprise, I discovered I was, and am, as decisive as anyone can be. I knew precisely what should be left in and what should be taken out, just like that. I have always been a terrific editor, if I do say so myself, and I do say so myself. But in private life, I can barely make a decision. I second-guess everything, from if I should wear the red or blue dress to where to go on vacation. Europe? South America? The Bahamas? Maybe I should just stay home. My daughter says my flip-flopping is because I'm a Libra. The astrological sign whose good traits include being diplomatic and urbane, and my favorite, romantic and charming, but whose not-so-good traits start with being indecisive and changeable. On my gravestone, I want inscribed, "On the other hand, maybe I should have lived." For quite a long time, Lee, my husband, not the princess, got up early every morning to watch me on Today. This was no small gesture on his part. He was a night person, as are most theatrical producers, and he usually stayed up till the wee hours going to Broadway plays and then on to Sardi's or Lindy's with all the other theater people. He also often had to go to one or the other of his theaters. Getting up at 7 was torture for Lee. After a few months, he started to check to see what time my particular spot was on, and then he set the alarm so he could catch just me. But even that wore thin, and after a while, Lee stayed gratefully asleep while I greeted the rest of the country as it awoke. I totally understood Lee's sleeping, although it gave us less and less to talk about when I came home for dinner. Our polar opposite schedules were not as difficult for me as they were for Lee. True, the hours were ghastly, but over time, they became a habit. I used 2 alarm clocks to make sure I woke up at 4:30. I wanted to be in the studio by 5:30. In order not to disturb Lee, I used to get up in the pitch black, tiptoe into my big closet, turn on my light, close the door, and dress there. In the early days, I washed my own hair every other day at home. On those mornings, I got up even earlier, at 4. Once I was in the studio, my hair would be set in big rollers and dried under a large hairdryer. Then, and during all my ensuing years on today, I would be made up by a wise and kind woman named Bobby Armstrong. Years later, when I left NBC to go to ABC, Bobby continued to work with me and was the greatest makeup artist, as well as the greatest comfort I could have. Back on the Today Show, the hour or so before I went on the air was some of the happiest time I could spend. If Judith Aileen and I happened to be on together, we gossiped away, shouting over the noise of the hairdryers. We all, including Hugh, got made up in the same large room, and it was there that we read scripts, made changes, and wrote notes for ourselves. Although the writers wrote the introductions to the interviews and suggested questions, I usually changed the introductions to suit what I thought sounded most like me, and I often rewrote my questions. The writers didn't mind. After all, I had been one of the writers myself. The atmosphere in the makeup room was warm and happy. We all genuinely liked one another. Sadly, little by little, things were getting to be less congenial at home. There were those times when Lee, quite naturally, wanted me to go to the theater with him. Otherwise, how could I share things in his life? I tried, though sometimes I would leave the theater after intermission. He understood, of course, and was very gracious about it, but he certainly would have preferred to have his wife by his side. To Lee's credit, he never asked me to give up my job, and we never competed with each other. I was in television, but was certainly not famous then, and we took pleasure in each other's successes, even if we rarely shared the actual experience. We also, of course, were still trying to have a baby, and that didn't make our lives easier. On the air, things were only getting better for me. The viewers seemed to like me, the sponsors liked me, the Alpo dogs really liked me, and more, I was on along with Judith and Aileen, not just on my specifically assigned 3 days. After a few months, it was decided that things were getting confusing and that it would be best if I became the only woman at the desk with Hugh while Judith and Aileen went back to their specialty roles. Judith became NBC's freelance theater and movie critic. Aileen, in addition to occasional appearances on Today, became NBC's general correspondent on the arts and later the host of NBC's local daytime program for women only. At the beginning of my new job as a 5-day-a-week full-timer on Today, I made the unbelievable-to-me salary of $750 a week. It was union scale, but I was thrilled. Maureen O'Sullivan might have been paid a far heftier salary, but it was more money than I had ever made. NBC gave me a 13-week contract. I stayed for 13 years. Becoming Barbara Walters. I was exhausted most of the time I was on the Today Show. I learned how to go to sleep anywhere, anytime I had a few minutes. That sometimes included 3-minute naps on the set during a commercial or while someone else was doing an interview. I was often so tired that if someone touched me, it felt almost like pain. To this day, I can nap anytime, almost any place. And if for some ungodly reason I receive a phone call at 5 a.m., I am instantly wide awake and make perfect sense. There were some things about waking before dawn that I liked. I really enjoyed drinking my morning coffee at the kitchen table when everything was still and quiet. It was the calmest time of my whole day. I liked the short drive from my apartment to the NBC studio. There was no traffic at 5 a.m., the light was just breaking. It was, in its way, so peaceful. Within 10 minutes, though, I would be in my dressing room, everyone hovering over me. The peace was over. Sometimes the whole show traveled. Al Morgan loved to take Today on the road. The expense was huge, involving not only the whole entourage of writers, producers, makeup artists, and the on-air people, but all kinds of technical support and equipment. But then, as now, foreign locales boosted the ratings, so the show would travel almost every year to one country or another. The most ambitious broadcast, in fact a historical first, took place on May 3, 1965, when Today broadcast live from Europe via Early Bird satellite. This was the inaugural telecast over the satellite, the first time an event taking place in Europe was seen live in the United States. Al ran the show from Brussels, Belgium, and orchestrated the feeds from Hugh Downs in London's Westminster Abbey, Jack Lasculli in Amsterdam, Aileen Saarinen at the Forum in Rome, Frank Blair on the Capitol steps in Washington, and me in Paris, with the singer and actor Yves Montand on his balcony overlooking the city. My job for this broadcast was to add some glamour by reporting on French cuisine, French couture, and French men. Not a bad assignment. This first satellite broadcast was so significant that it was introduced by Pope Paul VI speaking from the Vatican. Morgan said later he'd never forget saying, "Cue the Pope." A tough act to follow, but it was almost topped by live shots of adorable little girls in their respective countries saying, "Good morning, bonjour, buongiorno, and guten Morgen, this is Today." The next cut was to London and live coverage of the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace. The satellite broadcast was widely celebrated as a breakthrough for the future of television. The print media started to take more notice of television, and of me. There were at that time only two other significant women in television network news. One was Pauline Frederick, NBC's veteran United Nations correspondent, who was a highly distinguished reporter of some 20 years standing. Pauline truly was a trailblazer, but she was rather stern and unglamorous and got very little media attention. The other was a stylish figure named Nancy Dickerson, who had been at CBS before I started appearing regularly on Today, and was hired away by NBC to be their Washington correspondent. She was a good friend of the Beltway establishment. Lyndon Johnson was particularly fond of her. Nancy sat in for me several summers during my annual vacation, and evidently set her sights on my job. She organized a letter-writing campaign, suggesting that she would be better at the job than I, which hardly endeared her to me. It also made me quite anxious. I was still very insecure, and Nancy, in truth, was far better known than I. But then she shot herself in the foot. She was married to a very wealthy man and used to arrive at the NBC studios in a Rolls Royce, which set some people's teeth on edge. But it was her tendency, when she didn't get the assignment she wanted, to go above the producers' heads and complain directly to David Sarnoff, the chairman of RCA, NBC's parent company. This practice slowly eroded the support she might have had among the people she worked with. Both the producers of the evening news and the Today Show began using her less and less, and finally closed her out altogether. Her career continued for many years, but she never regained the prominence she had had in her early years at NBC. So that left me, a new face on the air and the object of curiosity. To the delight of the NBC publicity department, one article followed another. "That Barbara Walters is a girl no one can deny," began a full-page profile of me in the New York Herald Tribune on August 22, 1965. The women's movement had not yet rammed home the substitution of woman for girl, but no matter, I was happy with the media attention, especially the article's title, "They Love Her in the Morning." But not just for my ego, for my status with the brass at NBC. I'm not sure the Top Guns at NBC had much confidence in me during my early months on the program, until they read the mounting number of articles about me, including one of my favorites, also in 1965, in the New York Times. "Nylons in the Newsroom," by the beautiful, and later in her career, extremely influential feminist leader, Gloria Steinem. Gloria nailed the television industry's long-entrenched assumption that, as one male executive said, "Women didn't want to watch other women except on girl-type subjects." and used me as the most visible, non-girly woman on television to mark a step forward for womankind. I like my quote in Gloria's story, which more than 40 years later seems so prescient. If I wear anything below the collarbone, the viewers write shocked letters. I'm a kind of well-informed friend. They don't want me to be a glamour puss, and that's fine. It means I won't have to quit or have a facelift after 40. I'm in a different category. By the way, Gloria and I remain friends to this day. We even performed together at a charity event in Carnegie Hall. Gloria tap danced and I sang for me and my gal. We received great applause, but no one has asked us to repeat the performance. The reaction of NBC's executives to all this media coverage was predictable. Suddenly, I was their baby celebrity, as TV Guide put it back then. Before the media onslaught, I'd been working in a windowless office. After a feature in Life magazine quoted me as saying, "There are days when I don't see daylight," which was true, given the studio, which was also windowless, and the literal dawn-to-dusk hours I worked, I was given an office with a window. I was also given a secretary, Mary Hornicle, whom I didn't have to share. Wonderful Mary stayed with me for the next 12 years. My picture even went up on the corridor leading to the Today office, and NBC executives, including the CEO, actually said hello to me in the elevator. The network had two radio programs, Monitor and Emphasis, and I was asked to start contributing to both, which I did 5 days a week until I had to cut back my workload to three. Meanwhile, the media continued to feed off one another, and the brass fed on the media, and there I was, if not the toast of the town, at least a good bite. In actuality, my life didn't change very much. I never asked for and was not offered a raise. I had the same rent-controlled apartment and the same friends. Unlike people in the entertainment division, news people did not have a retinue of agents, publicists, personal managers, and hangers-on. I was happy just to have a secretary. I did get invited to premieres and opening nights of plays that I was usually too tired to attend, and there was the occasional glamorous party I went to, but basically, my life stayed the same. My friends didn't envy me because they knew how hard I worked and how tough the hours were. Unlike Hollywood, where an actor can make one smash film and his or her career can take off overnight, working in television news was, and is, a long and, if you're lucky, steady climb. I had begun that climb. The ripple effect grew beyond NBC. Within a year or two of my debut, I was asked to write a monthly column for the Ladies' Home Journal. Vogue asked me for 25 beauty secrets. Get enough sleep, probably, headed the list. Cosmopolitan asked me to model Pucci towels, and my name started to crop up in the columns. I got offers to lecture, to write a book. Nobody much cared what the subject was, to contribute personal items for charity auctions. Then came an invitation that really excited me, to appear as a guest on The Tonight Show with host Johnny Carson. If Today owned the beginning of the day, Johnny Carson owned the end of it. Nobody touched his ratings for 30 years. I was a nervous wreck before I walked out on the set, and I can't remember a word I said, but I must have done all right because he asked me back and a few years later even asked me to be a guest host while he was away. I don't smoke, but just before I was about to walk on Johnny's set, I used to bum a cigarette and take one puff. It made me slightly dizzy but relaxed. The night I guest hosted, I started with a monologue, as Johnny did every night. I talked about the difference between being a morning person and a night person like Johnny, how I had three breakfasts by noon and lived, mostly, on bagels. I had a vitamin deficiency, I said, for lack of vegetables. If it wasn't hilarious, it had the benefit of being true. Then I launched into my own tap dancing routine. I wasn't as good as Gloria Steinem, but I must have been passable. After all, I'd taken tap as a kid, remember? And this time, at least, the audience didn't boo. I even got invited to the White House, not to an intimate dinner with the Johnsons, who were then in residence, or even to a state dinner. But I was invited, nonetheless, to a celebration of the Head Start program. I wish I still had the invitation telegram from Lady Bird's secretary, the savvy Liz Carpenter, instructing me to present the telegram at the southwest gate of the White House. Was I ever pleased? That first invitation to the White House felt like one kind of award. Others were not quite so august. The Fragrance Foundation honored me at their annual Give Thanks for Women luncheon. Harper's Bazaar included me in its list of 100 Women of Accomplishment. Brandeis University gave me an award for achievement, and the National Father's Day Committee named me Woman of the Year. All these awards sound like big deals, but the truth is, as we know, that organizations use celebrities, even minor ones as I was, to sell tickets. It didn't matter too much what you had accomplished. Still, it beat Miss French Club or Most Improved Athlete. In the meantime, there was another and welcome shift in the cast of the Today Show. Sportscaster Jack Lasculli, who had gotten rather sour, left the show in 1967, and the upbeat and witty Joe Tell It Like It Is Garagiola arrived. Joe had been a professional baseball player and a sportscaster for the St. Louis Cardinals and the New York Yankees before he came to Today. Everyone was crazy about him, including Hugh and me. Joe stayed on the program until 1973, and in retrospect, those 4 years with Hugh and Joe were among the happiest years of my 40 years and counting tenure on television. The three of us appreciated one another's respective talents, and rather than compete, we made one another look good. This would not always be the case for me with other partners in the future, which is why I remember those years with such fondness. Over all this harmony on Today, however, loomed the shadow of my family. When I look back now at my father's life from the safe distance of so many years, I'm filled with admiration as well as compassion for him. His highs were so high, his lows so touchingly sad. While I was enjoying a brand new success, my father was suffering through what must have been such humiliation. Las Vegas was over and behind him. The Aquacade venture was a total failure, another reminder of his talent and imagination gone awry. He had almost nowhere to turn professionally, so he agreed to something that would have seemed beyond reason just a few years back. In 1965, he returned to the New York Latin Quarter, but this time he was neither an owner nor a partner. He was an employee. Not only that, he was working for the man he detested. Hat in hand, pride diminished, he accepted E.M. Lowe's offer to produce and direct the Latin Quarter shows. My mother packed their belongings and began the search for a new apartment in New York. How hard it must have been for my father. The program of the Latin Quarter now, which a customer could buy, was all about E.M. Lowe. It told how Lowe, who was described as soft-spoken, you could hear him from one end of the nightclub to the other, founded the club in Florida, and then, with a minor mention of my father, founded the New York club. But the dancers and staff knew better. When my father returned to the Latin Quarter and began rehearsals, the chorus girls cheered. Even the waiters had tears in their eyes as they set up the tables for the evening and saw Lou Walters back in what had been his home. This time, however, it was a very different situation. Lowe wasn't overly generous as an employer, and even though I was making more money than I had thought imaginable, I could only help so much. I took my mother and sister shopping for clothes and bought my father the new, warmer suits he would need for New York. The days of the penthouses were long gone. Instead, my mother rented a two-bedroom apartment on 8th Avenue and 50th Street, a decidedly unfashionable neighborhood. But the apartment was close to the Latin Quarter and was in a relatively new and clean building. Most of all, the rent was low. My mother moved whatever furniture she could from Florida, once again unpacked the dishes, glasses, pots, pans, and clothes, and settled in. Having my parents and my sister in New York was a mixed blessing. I got to see a lot more of them, which pleased us all, and they were very fond of Lee, which made our get-togethers easy and relaxed. But they didn't exactly bask in my success because they were always nervous that I would lose my job. They were proud and happy that I was doing so well, but it was pride tinged with the fear that my success might end, as it had for my father. Their fears often made me fearful too. I remember there was also a dog. My mother felt that my sister needed something of her own to love and care for, so she and Jackie went to an animal shelter and brought home a small sad mutt named Angel. Angel was a sweet animal, but scared of everything. Thunder, lightning, even traffic noises. Because my mother was usually the one to feed her, Angel became more attached to her than to Jackie. It was my mother who walked Angel because my mother didn't want Jackie to go out alone and saw no reason for Jackie to have to go out with her, especially on cold and rainy nights. I still have a vision of my mother, wearing her heavy coat, walking up and down that dismal street with that poor scared animal. It was not a happy existence for my mother, my father, or my sister, or even for poor Angel. I found it all so sad. My father continued at the Latin Quarter until 1969. That's when the union representing the chorus girls, the American Guild of Variety Artists, advised them to strike. The 14 girls, reduced in numbers from a high of 36, wanted a not outlandish raise of $30 a week. Lowe, true to form, refused. My father was caught in the middle. One newspaper quoted him as saying, "The demands really have been a little excessive, but Lowe could have settled the strike. He didn't." So the girls walked out. The Latin Quarter, a slightly shabbier version of its once glamorous self, temporarily closed its doors shortly before Christmas, losing all the profitable holiday business, then closed for good. And that was the end, in New York, not only of the last nightclub chorus line, but of my father's long-ago dream. Shortly thereafter, my family returned once more to Miami Beach. Their life was going downhill. Mine was on the way up. Now that I was becoming recognized, it made it easier for me to entice the big stars, like the British actor Peter Ustinov, and the incomparable Fred Astaire, to do interviews with me. Great names do not guarantee great interviews, I soon learned. The absolutely worst interview I ever conducted was with the actor Warren Beatty in the mid-60s. I had done all my usual preparation about Warren, who was coming on today to promote his latest movie, Kaleidoscope. Warren had become a first-rank star a few years earlier with his performance in the film version of William Ng's play Splendor in the Grass. I should have known when he appeared, rumpled and bleary-eyed, that trouble lay ahead. I pressed on, however, while he sat slumped in his chair, yawning and either grunting at my questions or giving monosyllabic answers. I finally resorted to the boring but necessary question, "Tell me, Mr. Beatty, what is your new movie about?" Silence. He scratched his chest, rubbed his hands through his hair, yawned again. More silence. "Well," he finally said, "that's really a very difficult question." That did it. "Mr. Beatty, you are the most difficult interview I've ever had," I said on national live television. "We'll go to a commercial." And we did. Warren has since become a very good friend, but by his own admission, he is a tough guy to interview. Despite the disaster with Beatty, the amount of positive press I was getting made it easier for me to get interviews with politicians as well as movie stars. If I couldn't always get the politician, I would usually interview the wife, and often they were more interesting than their husbands. Among them was Mamie Eisenhower, wife of former President Dwight David Eisenhower, who told me the secret of her 50-year marriage. "We have absolutely nothing in common." I also interviewed the First Lady, Lady Bird Johnson, who gave me my first tour of the White House and indirectly afforded me an unforgettable meeting with her husband. I was at the White House in the winter of 1968, preparing for the interview with Mrs. Johnson, when Liz Carpenter, Lady Bird's press secretary, asked me if I'd like to meet the president. He had a spare moment or two and had evidently asked Liz if I would drop by the Oval Office. I was somewhat taken aback. I had never met a U.S. president before and had not prepared in any way to meet him. But suddenly, there I was being ushered into that famous office, and there he was, all 6'3½" of him, looming over me. He swallowed my hand in his and asked if I wanted a Fresca. I'd never heard of the soft drink and thought wildly that it might be the name of a new dance, so I politely declined. President Johnson, who'd had his gallbladder removed a few years before, if you're old enough, you definitely remember the photos of him showing off his scar, and suffered from recurring heart trouble, then told me why he drank a lot of Fresca and other soft drinks. His doctors had told him he had to give up smoking, and drinking soda helped him fight the nicotine cravings. "It's god-awful," said the president. And with that, Lyndon Johnson, who liked to shock people with his sometimes coarse behavior, made a chopping motion over his groin. "I would rather they had told me to cut off my sex," he said. I was momentarily speechless. "So happy to meet you, Mr. President," I finally managed, and left the Oval Office. I never interviewed President Johnson, but I've always wished I could have. However, there were many other people to interview for today. I usually did 2 to 4 interviews a program, 5 days a week, and continued to do so, year in and year out, for 13 years. That's hundreds and hundreds of interviews. I obviously can't write about or even remember them all, but certain of the early interviews have stayed in my mind, and I think they stand the test of time. These particular people fascinated me 40 years ago. They still fascinate me today. Garland, Capote, Rose Kennedy, and Princess Grace. If ever there were 2 brilliant, mixed-up, hugely talented artists, they were Judy Garland and Truman Capote. I interviewed each of them on Today in 1967. Garland's career was already in decline. Her drinking and pill addiction had long since caused her to be abandoned by Hollywood. But music halls still loved her, and she was performing to standing ovations at the Palace Theater on Broadway. During one of her afternoons off, I went to do our interview. I was told to be in her hotel suite at noon. I was there. She was not. By 3 p.m., Garland had still not appeared. If it had not been the legendary Judy Garland, Elizabeth Taylor, another legend, would make me wait just as long, I would have left hours earlier. But finally, Garland emerged from the bedroom. Tiny, only 4'11", wearing a dress she said she borrowed from her teenage daughter, Lorna Luft, and proceeded to bowl me over with her charm, her humor, and her pathos. Daughter Liza with a Z, Minnelli, had just married Peter Allen, a singer-songwriter her mother had discovered in Hong Kong and who opened her acts for her. Allen, a talented performer himself, although never in either Judy's or Liza's league, was rumored to be gay, and the marriage ended 5 years later. But back then, Judy was rapturous about him. "He's a marvelous boy who's mad about her," she gushed to me, "and Liza is a lovely lady. I'm just terribly happy, terribly proud." The marriage was later called a mistake. Liza would go on to make at least 3 more marital mistakes, following the same pattern as her mother. Judy, who'd had 4 marriages by the time of our interview and would have another brief one in 1969, attributed her marital failure rate to her assorted husbands. "The minute they get entangled with me, they say how difficult it is to be married to me," she told me. "Well, why didn't they think of that before? The only mistake I ever made," she went on to say, "the only harm I ever did was sing Over the Rainbow." And then she laughed, although she wasn't entirely kidding about her signature song from The Wizard of Oz. She must have been sick of singing it night after night, year after year, whenever and wherever she performed. But what a tough life she'd had. Though much had been written about her background, it was chilling to hear her tell it in person. She had been performing, she told me, for 43 years, pushed on stage by her mother when she was a very small child. My mother was a witch, she stated. She would stand in the wings of the theater in which we were performing, and if I didn't feel good, if I was sick to my tummy, she would say, "You get out and sing, or I'll wrap you around the bedpost and break your ass." So, Garland said, I would go out and sing. Then came the movies, over 24 for MGM alone, including the classics with Mickey Rooney, whom Garland described as the most marvelous gentleman and the world's greatest talent. For the child star, however, life in Hollywood was not marvelous in any way. We worked night and day, Garland told me. I never went to a real school. You worked 6 days a week, sometimes 72 hours at a time. I could go weeks without a day off. And what did it get her? Sitting there, tiny and curled up in the hotel chair, dressed in her daughter's outfit, she was pathetic. Today, I'm broke, Garland admitted. So I better just go out there tonight and do what I always do, sing. It would be her final run at the palace. 2 years later, Garland died in London of an overdose of sleeping pills. She was 47. Truman Capote had a life that was, in its way, not terribly dissimilar from Judy Garland's. The author of Breakfast at Tiffany's, Capote began working for The New Yorker when he was just 17. He achieved fame with his first book, the best-selling Other Voices, Other Rooms, when he was only in his 20s. Capote, a notoriously heavy drinker, died of liver disease in 1984 at the age of 59. But back in 1967, he was riding high. He was being celebrated for his brilliant 1966 so-called nonfiction novel, In Cold Blood, which was being made into a movie starring Robert Blake, whom I would interview years later when he was accused of murdering his wife. Truman had also made social headlines just a year before our interview by hosting a legendary masked ball in the Grand Ballroom of the Plaza Hotel, honoring Katharine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post. It was referred to as the Black and White Ball and was packed with what were dubbed the beautiful people. Scores of celebrities, journalists, society people, politicians, and movie stars covered their faces with elaborate masks, the women in black or white ball gowns, the men in black tie. It was a triumph. By the way, I wasn't invited, I wasn't a big enough celebrity, and I was hardly considered a member of the beautiful people, thank goodness. In 2006, Philip Seymour Hoffman won an Academy Award portraying Capote in his prime in the film Capote. To my pride and pleasure, Hoffman told me at a party that he had watched my interview something like 50 times to capture, as he did so well, the personality quirks of the character he would play. There was much for him to draw on. Are you ever bored? I asked Capote. No, because I'm terribly curious, he replied. It's very hard for me to get bored because even when somebody's being actively boring, I'm interested in how they are boring me. I'm analyzing that, and so that keeps me entertained. What do I do when I feel blue? Read. I hardly ever feel blue, but I have a great sense of tragedy. I take a tragic view of life, and it's really that which accounts for the frivolous things that I do. It's sort of a compensation for having this completely dark view all the time. Another of Capote's answers from my interview forecast his eventual decline. The only thing I couldn't do without is my own conviction about my own creative gifts. If I didn't have that, I think I would feel very desolate. You see, the thing about me is that I'm really several people. I spend a great deal of time alone, and I work very hard. Then there's this other side of me that is constantly keeping up with everything. I need people. 10 years later, Capote wrote too honestly and bitingly about the beautiful people who were so important in his life. When they abandoned him after he exposed them in print, he went into the despair and desolation he had described in our interview and all but stopped writing. His last memorable quote from the interview has to do with art and God. I happen to think that art is a form of religion and a way of reaching God. Occasionally, and very rarely, in sudden moments, one feels in art a state of grace. It is as though a voice from a cloud is speaking to you and dictating to you what is transmitted through your hands to art. It is a religious experience. Years later, I had the opportunity to interview the great actor Sir Laurence Olivier. When I asked him how he wanted to be remembered, his answer was very similar to Capote's. "Something like an expert workman," he said. "A workman," I repeated. "That sounds so prosaic." "Does it?" said Olivier, reflecting for a moment. "Well, I think a poet is a workman. I think Shakespeare was a workman. And God is a workman. I don't think there's anything better than a workman, or workwoman." Then there was my interview with Rose Kennedy. God was not a workman to Mrs. Kennedy. He was central to her whole being. She attended Mass every day. Her faith in God gave her courage, conviction, and most of all, solace. I quote her now because of what it says about her remarkable sons. Mrs. Kennedy, the wife of Joseph P. Kennedy, the very wealthy and controversial businessman and one-time U.S. ambassador to the Court of St. James, was the mother of President John F. Kennedy, Senators Robert and Edward Kennedy, and six other children. Two of them, Joseph Jr. and Kathleen, were killed in plane crashes in the 1940s. Another daughter, Rosemary, was brain damaged and lived in a special home where she was cared for most of her life. Then in the 1960s, President Kennedy and Senator Robert Kennedy were assassinated. It must have been agony for a mother to bear. But Mrs. Kennedy never lost her verve, her courage, or her faith. Growing up in Boston and having summered on Cape Cod, both places where the Kennedys had homes, I felt a special kinship. As I've already told you, Joseph Kennedy Sr. had spent a good deal of time at the Latin Quarter in Florida. Mrs. Kennedy, however, never set foot in the club. To a very large degree, husband and wife lived separate lives. For a long period of time, Joseph Kennedy conducted an affair with the motion picture actress Gloria Swanson. He even produced several movies for her. Mrs. Kennedy, by all accounts, both knew and accepted this arrangement. She was a good-looking woman herself, dark hair, a dazzling smile, very thin and very chic. It seemed almost natural to her that her husband had other romantic interests, a trait his sons inherited if the hundreds of stories are to be believed. Mrs. Kennedy remarked that her husband had rarely been with her when she gave birth to her 9 children. "No matter," she said with a smile and a wink. "A diamond bracelet makes up for the loss." But what could make up for the loss of so many of her children? The following is what she told me in November 1968. That month would have been the birthday celebration of her son Robert, who had been assassinated just 5 months before. It was also the 5th anniversary of the assassination of her older son, Jack. "I just made up my mind that I was not going to be vanquished," she told me. "If I collapsed, then it would have a very bad effect on the other members of the family. So I think I owe them a certain calmness and encouragement, and that's what I try to do." She continued, "I'm interested in a lot of things. I have children and grandchildren. I have this motto which I found in one of Jack's favorite books. It was actually said with regard to England, but I adopted it as my own motto. I know not age or weariness of defeat. And I don't analyze my feelings, I just keep on being interested." I went on to ask Mrs. Kennedy whether when her children were young, there was talk of one of the sons being president. She replied, "Well, I think their father always had that idea, but I wasn't conscious of it when they were growing up. I was just very much occupied in seeing that they were mentally, physically, and—" Here Mrs. Kennedy paused, and I threw in, "psychologically?" "No," Mrs. Kennedy said, "morally all right." She went on, "You know, they talk about a Kennedy dynasty, but I'm quite sure that there will be another family who will come right along, and that is what makes life exciting." Then Mrs. Kennedy laughed. "That and the absurdity of life also makes it exciting for everybody." 4 children dead, and she could laugh and talk of the absurdity of life. A remarkable woman. I ended the interview by asking if she ever gave her son's advice. She said she had told Jack during his presidency that he should not stand with his hands in his pockets and that he would look much better if he held his hands behind his back, as the British did in photographs. She also recalled giving Bobby some advice in a letter, but ended it by saying that it might be the last time she would write such a letter because Socrates, who used to give a lot of advice, was finally given hemlock to drink. No wonder Rose Kennedy was one of my favorite interviews. The Kennedys in those days were considered American royalty. But we actually had our own royal princess, though my interview with Her Serene Highness, Princess Grace of Monaco, didn't give me quite the pleasure that the Rose Kennedy interview did. The interview with the beautiful ex-movie star, which I recently watched again, took place in Monte Carlo in August 1966. It isn't one of my happiest memories, nor, I dare say, was it hers. The 1956 marriage of the cool patrician Grace Kelly to the eligible bachelor Prince Rainier was called the Wedding of the Century. Monaco, the tiny principality on the French Riviera, is chiefly known as the home of one of the most picturesque and well-known gambling casinos in Europe. It is also known as a tax haven for millionaires who can save money while they moor their yachts, play blackjack, or just sun themselves at the topless Monte Carlo Beach Club. Monaco and its principal, and I think only city, Monte Carlo, is smaller than New York Central Park. But no matter. Prince Rainier was European royalty, and with her perfect features, blue eyes, and blonde hair, Grace was our version of American royalty. Most of her leading men, from William Holden to Ray Milland, to Bing Crosby to Clark Gable, all of them huge stars at that time, were said to have been in love with her. But one day, while she was in Cannes filming To Catch a Thief with Cary Grant, she was introduced to the bachelor prince, and voila, as they say in French-speaking Monaco, an engagement was soon announced. She was the Princess Diana of her time, and for weeks reporters covered every aspect of the engagement and wedding. The public couldn't get enough of it. Who were her bridesmaids to be? What was she going to wear? They showed copies of the hats Grace was supposedly going to take on her honeymoon. I think I even bought one. It was a fairy tale wedding. Escorted down the aisle by her father, Grace, wearing a gown designed by MGM costume designer Helen Rose, presented a picture as elegant as Hollywood could create. But this wasn't Hollywood. This was real. Grace Kelly, our golden-haired princess, then disappeared behind the walls of the palace in Monte Carlo, and we only read about her or saw photos of her from then on. She never made another film. Her Serene Highness had also done no television interviews, and for years I had written letter after letter trying to get her to sit down with me. Finally, 10 years after her marriage and 3 children later, 2 girls and the proper male heir, the palace authorities must have felt that it was time for their royal sovereign to be interviewed, and a date was arranged for me to come to Monte Carlo. This was to be her first television interview since the wedding. Princess Grace greeted me in the garden of the palace just 15 minutes later than our appointed time, which was certainly a leg up on Judy Garland. It is considered appropriate by most Europeans to curtsy to royalty. It is not appropriate for Americans to curtsy. I didn't, nor did I shake hands. I just sort of bowed a bit from the waist and smiled. The princess was in a casual dress and flat-heeled shoes, and we walked together to the palace swimming pool with a tiny rowboat in the middle of it. There we sat and talked. Some excerpts. Barbara. Most of us think of a princess as sleeping in bed until noon, having breakfast in bed, ladies in waiting, many servants. Is your life anything like what I have just described? Grace. People always romanticize my life. To a great deal, my life is not much different from any woman who works and has a great many obligations and a great many things to do and 3 children to look after. Barbara. Do you think it is a very different life than if you had remained an actress and married someone in the motion picture business? Grace. Yes, I believe so, because when I was acting, my private life was very much my own. and now my private life is very public. Barbara, and people like me come and sit and ask you all kinds of questions. Grace, which are very difficult to answer. So far, I thought I was asking rather banal and boring questions, not at all hard to answer. Barbara, what was most difficult for you to adjust to as a princess and a monarch when you first came here? Grace, that's a big change in anyone's life. Different culture, different language. I spoke a little bit of French, but not much. I could ask the questions, but I couldn't understand the answers. Barbara, is a European husband very different from an American husband? Is Prince Rainier very different from your own brothers? Grace, a European husband is definitely the head of the household. There are no two ways about it. I know European men are always shocked by the relationship between an American man and wife. For instance, if an American wife contradicts her husband in public, which often happens. American women are outspoken and forthright and honest and say what they think. This shocks European men quite a bit. I mean, you would never find a European woman correcting her husband in front of other people. Barbara, in the early days of your marriage, did you find yourself doing it? Did you learn quickly? Grace, I learned a lot of things. Laughs. I think the thing that has helped me most in my marriage and adjusting to life here is the fact that the prince and I share the same religion. It's been a great bond between us, and I think that has helped us overcome any of the differences of our backgrounds and culture. Note that there was no mention of the word love. Barbara, how many rooms are there in the palace here? Grace, I don't know. I suppose there are over 200. I think I read that once. We went on to talk of how the people regarded her. She thought many people in Monaco still considered her to be a foreigner. She continued to think of herself as an American. I asked if there was any role that tempted her to come back to films. She said possibly Ibsen's Hedda Gabler, who, by the way, kills herself at the end of Act 4. Barbara, if one of your daughters wanted to be a movie star, would you object? Grace, I think so, yes. Barbara, why? Grace, I don't think it is ever a career or life one chooses for a daughter. Barbara, and yet you chose it for yourself. So what if your child says, Mother, you did, why not me? Grace, I'll face that problem when or if it comes. Barbara, my final question. Your Highness, I must ask you what most Americans want to know about you. Are you happy? Grace, I suppose I have a certain peace of mind, yes. And my children give me a great deal of happiness, and my life here has given me many satisfactions. Ye gods, a certain peace of mind? No joy, no pride, and no mention of her husband? A certain peace of mind, that is the best definition of happiness for Her Serene Highness Princess Grace of Monaco? She must have realized how this sounded, because when I thanked her most courteously, she had tears in her eyes. True, it might have been because she had never done a television interview before, and answering questions that were not part of a script might have bordered on torture for her. Still, after meeting her, I always felt that she was living an unexpected life of disappointment. It would end in 1982, in an automobile accident with her 17-year-old daughter, Stephanie. The car, which Grace was driving, plunged off the steep hairpin turn road above Monaco, fatally injuring Grace, but sparing her daughter, who was only bruised and would be treated for shock. Grace was only 52, and there was conjecture that she might have suffered a stroke before the accident. Strange, the other two most beautiful and interesting women of that generation, at least to me, Audrey Hepburn and Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, also died way before their time.